Welcome everyone to episode 106 of the New Gen Mindset Podcast. I'm Dan Kozel here with Nick Tartaglia. I know we keep bringing this up, but energy and Bitcoin.
Energy and Bitcoin.
And then you've got mining.
And mining.
Because they're all linked. I was watching a PragerU video last night talking about this whole green energy transition. And what I found so fascinating was like, the governments across the world, particularly in the US, they spent about $500 trillion and they've only been able to move the needle by like 1.5%. So what does that tell you? I think what it tells you is that the energy that has been around for decades is going to be here forever. I mean, you can't replace it. But in order for us to achieve sort of this green dream that everyone's talking about, we need more mining. There needs to be like 15 times more mining than there is right now, right?
It's been, I mean, you kind of see it in the trend going on with Apple, Mercedes, Volkswagen companies coming out left and right saying, well, the plan of 2030 or 2035 to go all EV, they've kind of bailed on the plan because they've kind of realized it just doesn't make sense. The supply chain has not evolved and adapted yet to supply and this forced demand that's kind of happening. So there's this reality starting to kind of snap back into place. But has the market kind of waking up to this dilemma? No, I don't think so necessarily. It's kind of still risk on. Look at Bitcoin. Bitcoin's ripping it. It's already up almost 50% since the beginning of February. So I think it's just a matter of a contrarian play, just patience.
Yeah, and I think with everything going on globally, people are going to slowly start realizing just how important mining is. Now, we're pretty biased on this show, but the charts are pretty much saying that we're probably bottoming of this mining super cycle. And so what we wanted to do today is bring on a gentleman who's got an extensive amount of experience in the world of finance. He actually began his trading career in Japanese equity markets in the mid-1980s. And I think the Nikkei just hit an all-time high last week. And he is currently the senior advisor to Matterhorn Asset Management, which is based in Switzerland, and a portfolio and strategy advisor to, and I apologize if I mispronounce this, but Vopes Investment Management in Singapore. And now he's got a very unique website and newsletter where he talks about copper, gold, and silver. And I love the name of this newsletter, but things that make you go, with us here today. Is Grant Williams. Welcome to the New Gen Mindset Podcast.
Hey, gents. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Of course. So, Grant, the first thing we always like kind of get to do is understand the history of the people we bring on. So do you mind kind of just, you know, give us a little backstory to, you know, your education, your career, how you got to this point in time?
Well, I am definitely not new gen, as you can probably tell from the color of my hair. I'm very definitely old gen. So to condense, next year will be my 40th year in market. So let me try and condense that for you. As you say, I began my career in the Japanese equity markets in the mid 80s, which was the, you know, the kind of last 5 years of that crazy, crazy bubble we had there. And since then, I spent a lot of time focused and living in Asia, Singapore, Hong Kong, Japan itself. I spent some time living down in Australia, trading the Aussie markets down there. Spent a number of years in New York and, of course, London. And, you know, it's funny, my education really began with the job. You know, it's funny, you come into these markets and no matter what education you've had prior to that, they will tear it up for you in a hurry and make you learn on the fly. And so, you know, I've been through booms and busts and everything in between. And it's amazing how many similarities there are. In every particular period, whenever you hear someone say, well, this is unprecedented, I guarantee you it isn't. You might have to dig a little deeper sometimes into the history books to find out or to find previous examples. They're never the same, but there's always enough information because we are cyclical creatures, humans, and we tend to repeat the same mistakes over and over again. And we let our emotions drive us to the same highs, the same kind of lows. And so it's all there. Everything that's happened is there in the history books in one form or another. And so, you know, we talk about education. I think reading history is perhaps the single greatest education you can have in terms of understanding markets. So I would encourage everybody listening to this to read as much history, financial and otherwise, as you possibly can.
That's very important because people tend to forget. I think humans are just very short-sighted creatures, right? We're all short-term. It's only been, what, 4 years since COVID, but I think a vast majority of the people have forgotten about it. But maybe just walk us back when you first started briefly. Like, what do you feel like were some of the key lessons that you've applied now? But when you see it unfolding, you're kind of like, oh, I've seen this before.
Well, the Japanese equity bubble and real estate bubble, we had twin bubbles at the same time, so there's one similarity for you there. It was a mania, and I was very young. You know, it was my first job, and so I saw it with no context, with no real framework with which to navigate it, and I relied very much on the amazing group of people that I worked with to kind of help me through it. And really, I just wanted to get through it. It wasn't the time. The first few years were a period of it was very difficult not to make money. The markets just kind of seemingly went up every day, and so you tended to lose money when you got caught offsides in a position that you had to, you know, sell to a customer or something. That you tended to get hurt pretty badly some days. And then you could see the mania. I was living in Japan at the top, and there's a famous story that at the peak of the Japanese bubble, the land that the Emperor's Palace was built on in the center of Tokyo was supposedly worth more than the entire state of California. And you read things like that, even at the time, and you think, okay, this has gone too far, but you still have to get up every day and participate. And so, you know, I watched the people around me who I had a great deal of respect for get more risk averse. I watched some of the smartest fund managers and analysts start to be sellers every day rather than buyers every day. This was long before the New Year's Eve 89 top. And I think, you know, when you find people who have been successful through cycles, they're often a great indicator of when you should start to think. And I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday, and they were talking about how in 07, you know, they started to see a couple of signs that it was time to lighten up on exposure, and they overrode those signs and said, yeah, I'll just wait for the next signal. And by then it was too late. And they did the same thing at the bottom in March 09. You know, they started to see things stabilizing, but were too gun-shy to pull the trigger and thought, I'm just going to wait for confirmation of that, and missed the bottom. And so I think once you've experienced those things, it's much easier to again put them in historical context. And so I think I've always said this to my kids, you know, there are things I can teach you, but there are things you have to learn. And oftentimes in this business, the things you have to learn is going through those periods and making those mistakes yourself, despite what anyone can tell you. Hey, if you see this, and this, I don't care how gnarly it is, buy everything with both hands. Until you've been faced with that, not done it like you were told, and seen what happens afterwards, it's very difficult to take those kind of things on faith. So there really is no substitute for experience in this business. And the people who are trying to trade their way through the markets today, even if they get beaten up, what's happening today is going to stand you in very, very good stead the next time things get squirrely, because you will have that human experience to look back on and recall, and that will help you make what seem like tough decisions.
I love that you said that here, and Nick, I'll let you ask the next question here, but I just want to make a quick comment. You could, very interesting quote now. I could teach you so much, but there's other things you got to learn on your own. That is so true to everything that's happening right now. And I think to your point, it comes down to someone's level of conviction too. Whereas in theory, you sit in a finance class and they're like, well, you're supposed to buy low and sell high. It's like, well, obviously, but when there's all these variables and sort of the psychological sentiment in your mind, and there's all this fear that comes in, your level of conviction until you're actually in the markets, you're not going to be able to learn that with a demo account, right? So you got to be able to just stomach that. And again, to your point, that only comes with experience. You can't teach that. That just comes by doing that and then maybe losing money and then gaining money later on, right?
Well, conviction is an interesting word, right? Because we generally only ever have too much of it or too little of it. That's the reality. You know, we've always got too much conviction at the top, and we've never got enough at the bottom. And there's a dear friend of mine, Peter Atwater, just published a book kind of towards the end of last year called The Confidence Map. And I would recommend everybody listening to this to go out and buy a copy of that book, not just because Peter's a friend, but it's a terrific book. You know, people kind of send me books and say, oh, look, would you read my book and tell me what you think? And whenever you get books from friends, you're always nervous thinking, please let it be good. Please let it be good. I don't have to try and find something nice to say. And Peter's book is sensational. He talks about confidence and vulnerability, and he offers a really interesting and simple framework to think about those two things and how they drive decisions. And so understanding this idea of conviction, yes, you have to have conviction, but as soon as you have conviction, you are going to end up having too much of it. Because if you have the conviction to, you know, whatever, let's talk about buy gold. If you have the conviction to buy gold, in your head, you instantly don't want to be wrong, right? And so you will ignore signs that if you didn't have a position would make you think, oh, this looks a bit dicey. You will ignore signs because you have conviction. You put the trade on, you put capital at stake, and you don't want to be wrong. And so you have instantly too much conviction. And at the bottom, you know, we'll think, oh, God's a great idea, but you see it getting beaten down every day. And you don't have enough conviction. You know, you know it's a good thing to buy, but because of what the market's telling you, what other people are telling you, who probably don't have the same kind of conviction as you, they're just trading things, it tends to color our opinions. And again, you know, it's only really experience of finding ways to understand why and when you missed out on opportunities and why you got over your skis at the top. You know, there's a famous story that Stan Druckenmiller tells about the 2000 tech bubble. You know, he was sitting on a desk, and the guys on the desk next to him, a couple of young guys who were trading all the internet stocks, and he knew it was a bubble, and they were just making so much money. He'd sat the whole thing out, and in the end, he just couldn't stomach it anymore. These guys were making so much money, and he missed out, and he jumped in, even though he knew it was a bubble, and promptly lost $1 billion of Soros's money. And years later, he was being interviewed by the late Ken Langone on stage. And you know, they talked about this story. And he said to Ken, asked Stan the question. He said, you know, what did this teach you? What did you learn from this experience? Stan's answer was absolutely brilliant. He said, nothing. I learned absolutely nothing. I knew I shouldn't have done it, and I did it anyway. So yes, he learned nothing. But I guarantee you that reinforced within the next time around, I've been here before, I'm going to fight that urge to get involved and participate because I do know it's a bubble. And now I know not only it's a bubble to avoid it, but I have a visceral experience of what happens if you don't pay attention to that. So, you know, again, history, whether it's personal or otherwise, is just always a tremendous asset to have.
There's a thing that Rick Rule often likes to say is love what's unloved. And it kind of like, and at the same time, it kind of shows you the perspectives between a bottom and a top. Is oftentimes when things are at the bottom, they're hated. So you kind of have to fight through that noise to kind of create this conviction to, okay, let me get in at the bottom, regardless of the hate that's going on with that specific asset class. And oftentimes when assets are at peak bubbles and they're really pushing, the narrative on the main street kind of is driving everybody to get into the market. Kind of like what you're seeing now, Bitcoin's flying. A lot of the big names in the stock market are flying. And a lot of people seem to be convicted to entering it now. But at the same time, kind of just like what you said with Drunken Miller, he just pulled out of Alibaba, sold Amazon, sold some Alphabet. You have the Walmart family selling stock at the top. You have Jeff Bezos, who just sold $8 billion worth. And at the same time, you have regular investors that are thinking that they're feeling confident getting to the market again right now. So at the same time, people have to realize, kind of like what you're saying, is you have to fight through that noise to figure out, does this make sense, or is it just noise pulling me in to take advantage of my lack of understanding of the market? And with that said, do you have any comments on kind of what's going on in the current market? And do you see any validation in the fact that some of these big players are starting to sell out at the top while people are starting to get in?
Yeah, if you look at the data on insider sales, they are at insane levels. Insane levels. And you know, obviously the Bezoses and the Diamonds of the world and the Robin Denholm at Tesla and all the big names get a lot of the attention. But just look at the data on total insider sales, and they're beyond crazy. And so insiders who, you know, it's not inside information, they're running the business. They have a much better understanding of the health of their particular business than we do. And they are selling hand over fist. Now, a lot of these things are 105B plans that they put in place to sell over the next few months, or you know, at whatever price is, that decision of the price is taken out of their hands, they're scheduled. But that shouldn't distract you from the fact that they are happy to sell shares essentially at any price over the next few months, right? So it's definitely a signal. You know, you mentioned our mutual friend, the great Rick Rule there. You know, Rick also says, never confuse brains with the bull market. Mm-hmm. And he's absolutely right. You know, that's one of the key things that people do wrong, is that they buy something, the market goes up, and we never care why something's going up. No one ever really spends the time to do a post-mortem on a stock they bought that's going up. No one sits down to say, is this stock going up for the reasons I thought it was going up? And if not, why not? Why is it going up? When it goes down, we all want to know why it's gone down. Why has this gone against me? Why is this going down? What are the reasons for it going down? But people don't tend to care when things go the right way. And that can be very dangerous, because understanding why something's going up can help you understand what might make it turn around. If you think a stock's going to go up for a certain set of reasons, and it goes up and all of those reasons turn out to be incorrect, you should reevaluate whether you still want to hold that stock. Just because a stock's going up is not a good reason to hold it, you know, because a point in time will come. NVIDIA is the perfect poster child for this right now. If you own NVIDIA because it's going up, that's absolutely fine, as long as you get out before it starts to go down, because it will go down, hard to believe given the way it's gone up, but it'll go down harder and faster than it's gone up, because it always does, you know. And this is down to the emotions that drive investors in both directions, you know, greed and fear. Not everybody gets greedy, but everybody gets fearful. And so the down moves are always much, much sharper than the up moves. You know, you never see upward crashes in stock markets. You see strong days, but you don't see crashes. And because of the nature of greed, these things suck more and more people in along the way. And so that's why you get these blow-off tops when people like Druckenmiller couldn't in 99-2000. You just can't stay out anymore. And that tends to be what produced these parabolic tops. And once everybody's in, there's nobody left to buy. And so, you know, the markets right now, there are thousands of people who will tell you what to buy and how to get involved in this bull market. And if that's what you want to know, is what stock should I buy to take advantage of this bull market, then you need to think about that as a motivation. You know, I just want to buy the things that are going up versus, and I've been talking about this a lot lately, I want to own interests in great businesses. Two very, very different investment mindsets. And, you know, the beauty now is that there are a lot of great businesses that people have taken their eye off, because they're not going crazy. They're not doing what NVIDIA is doing. They're not AI related, but they're really solid businesses. And, you know, again, I, for anyone that's listening to this, that's heard me talk lately, I've been talking a lot about this, so I apologize for repeating myself, but, you know, it's really important to understand the difference in mindset between buying shares and investing in a company. They are two completely and utterly different things. And over time, we have, and by we, I mean the investment public, have become conditioned into thinking about buying shares, buying a stock. Oh yeah, I'm buying Apple. Not, I want to own a piece of Apple's business. Because if you owned a piece of Apple's business, right now, you would be asking yourself some serious questions about the long term, given, you know, a lot of the announcements that happened, a lot of the changes in the iPhone business, the Vision Pro. There are questions to ask about that business and its future cash flows. And once you start asking that, you can then look at the valuation and say, is this company fairly valued for how I think the cash flows are going to change over time? If you're buying Apple stock, you're looking at the chart and saying, it looks like there's resistance here and there's support there, and I'm going to hang on to this, I'm going to hang on to that. It's not to say either is better than the other, but you need to understand what it is you're doing. If you are buying a stock, you are basically looking to sell it for a higher price. If you're investing in a company, you're looking to own a share of its cash flows for the future. And it's a very, very different mindset. So my first piece of advice to anybody who wants to be in the markets is, understand what do you want to do. Are you a speculator? Are you an investor? And calibrate accordingly.
That's a very underappreciated topic in investing, period. Because I always get messages from friends because, you know, look, I'm 20% of my portfolio, I speculate, right? The other 80% is applying the investment mindset, the investment principles, and looking at future cash flows. But you're right, because there's a, especially with the younger generation, because we've been conditioned for the longest time to essentially buy something, throw a dartboard, it's going to go up, and then you make money, and then you're successful, or you've won the trade, or you've made money. And then what tends to happen is in a down cycle, people that start doing that same sort of strategy, they start scratching their head. They're like, why am I losing money? I'm getting impatient. They get out of a position. So they actually end up losing more over time without even realizing it, right? So I'm really glad you brought that up, because it is such an underappreciated discussion or an underappreciated topic, where given the magnitude of NVIDIA, given how well Bitcoin has marketed itself, everyone just assumes if you buy Bitcoin, that's how the stock market works. That's how investing works. And it's totally misconstrued, right?
Well, there's another layer to this as well, right? And that is the ETF phenomenon. Because what we've done is we've found a way to distill ideas into three-letter tickers. And this is great, right? Because now you can read an article in the FT and think to yourself, oh man, you know, I want to be long the UK. I've just read an article, the UK is undervalued. And at that point, you've got a choice to make. Do I go and research the top 100 companies in the UK and understand their businesses, look at the state of those businesses and work out how I think those businesses are positioned for the future, the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, and work out which ones offer me a good way to get exposure to the UK? Or do I buy the UK ETF, right? And everything's been done to make that decision really simple for you, and to make the amount of work you have to do much less. So you go and buy, I want to get long the UK. So what's the UK ETF? Long UK. So I'm going to buy the FTSE ETF. Great. And again, I had this conversation with a friend yesterday. You know, you now own an ETF of a bunch of companies which are headquartered in the UK, the vast majority of which either have zero or very little business in the UK. They're actually exposed to the US market or the Far East market or whatever. You don't own the UK at all. But you think like you do, and then you start to question, why is this UK ETF not performing? You know, the UK seems to be doing well, the inflation data is mild, blah, 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 blah. Why is my ETF not doing well? And the simple reason is you didn't do the work. You didn't do the work. You've distilled a very complex set of decisions into a three-letter acronym. And that's fine when everything's going up like they have been recently, but understanding what you own is imperative. And you know, the entire history of progress, technological, from the plow, from the wheel, from the fire to AI, is about one thing and one thing only, right? It's done so that human beings have to expend less energy, period, whether it be mental or physical. That is progress. And so everything we do, whether it be in the fields of manual labor or technology or in investing, is done with the aim of allowing us to do less work. And when you do less work and you are encouraged to think that there is less work that you need to do, it leads to unfortunate outcomes, but it also throws up tremendous opportunities for those people who are willing to do the work and those people who are willing to investigate a company and understand a company's businesses, understand the threats it faces, understand where it's strong, where it's weak, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, if I could encourage people to do anything, it would be that. It would be to expend the extra energy required to understand what it is you're buying, whether it's an ETF or a country ETF or a sector ETF, or it's an individual business. Do some work, because if you don't do the work and you find that your ETF is not performing the way you suspect it should be, there's nowhere to look but the mirror, unfortunately. There just isn't. We all need to understand exactly what it is we own, why we own it, and what it would take for us to change our minds. And that's difficult to do if you own an ETF, because there are so many different factors that go into the pricing of that.
We just saw recently that England and Japan have been considered technically now in a recession. And on the backdrop of that, if you have any comments on that, would also be, what asset classes do you like or do you really think have been ignored and have significant value when you take into account that almost most asset classes are pretty expensive or overvalued?
Well, there's a great question here, but if you think about that question, you've just reinforced the last point I made. You know, we're talking about which asset classes do you like, right? So the answer is that you could say bonds. What does that tell you? That doesn't really give you any information. Or I could say Japan. It doesn't give you any real information. Or you know, gold miners. Again, understanding the assets that someone likes, asset classes that someone likes, is incredibly broad. Mm-hmm. And if I were to say to you, I like high yield bonds, the danger, and I'm not saying that, by the way, mm-hmm. to anyone listening, let's be perfectly clear, but the danger with me arming you with that information is extreme, right? Let's say I'm a distressed yield expert and I say, you know, I really like some distressed bonds right now. And someone listening to this goes, oh, distressed expert guy likes distressed bonds. He thinks they're great. Well, of course I do, because that's my business. So what can I do? You know, I'm going to buy JNK. I'm going to buy the junk bond ETF. Great. You have no idea what's in that. You have no idea of the pitfalls of owning that damn thing. Whereas me and my team of 20 analysts are poring over the balance sheets, the you know, the quarterly numbers, the conference calls of all these companies, speaking to management, trying to figure out which credits are good, which credits aren't. And so, you know, again, this idea of shortcuts, this idea of listening to people talking in podcasts like this and like my podcast and other similar ones to get trade ideas is such a dangerous thing to me. It's such a dangerous thing. And it's why I basically refuse to talk about individual stocks, because I have absolutely no idea what people are going to do with that information, or whether it's suitable for them, or whether what their risk appetite is, what their level of sophistication is. It's so fraught with danger, not for me, but for the people listening, just, you know, listening to the guy on the podcast. You know, I'm very happy to sit and talk with the people that I work with on a one-to-one basis and talk about every kind of individual company or sector or whatever it may be. But I know exactly what their aims are. I know exactly what their risk tolerances are. I know exactly what their level of their capital is. And so for me, these conversations are a much better platform to try and teach people how and why. You know, everybody wants to know what. And again, mm-hmm. that's the shortcut question. What should I buy? And people often don't take it any further than that. Tell me mm-hmm. what to buy and I'll buy it, because you're smarter than me and I want to make money, and you obviously made money because you wouldn't be on the podcast. So tell me what to do and I'll do it. What's not the question? The question is how and why. The question is how do you think and why do you think? Not what do you think? Why do you think that way? And if people spent more time asking about the hows and the whys, they could figure out the whats for themselves, right? And that should be the ultimate aim of everybody who wants to invest, is figure out how to come up with your own trade ideas, because then you take real ownership of them. You understand why you've bought something. You tend not to pull the trigger until you're certain. And the responsibility is all yours. You know, if I gave you a three-letter stock ticker now and someone bought it, so listening to me on the radio, on the podcast, yeah, I'm going to buy that stock. It sounds like a great idea. You know, we stop recording this. It takes you a couple of days to edit it, put it out. Person in question might not listen to it for 3 or 4 days until they get around to it in their list of other podcasts that they want to listen to. And then they say, oh, what a great idea. And they look at the stock, it looks okay. In that week period of time, anything could have happened. I could have seen a story on this stock that caused me to sell my entire position and talk to my clients and say the same thing. Look, you know, I was wrong about this, get out. Or the run's over, get out. There's no responsibility on me to come to call you guys up and say, hey, you need to let me either edit that thing, take that bit out, or have me back on the podcast because things have changed. And so someone out there takes the advice from a week ago, buys a particular security, and then watches it start to go down, and A, think I'm an idiot, which is totally fair, I am, But two, they don't know what to do about it. They don't, like, I was told this was going to go up. It's going down. That must mean it's going to go up soon. And so I'm going to hang on to it. And it keeps going down. And they can't understand why, because that smart guy on the podcast who turned out to be an idiot told me to buy it. Well, what do I do now? Should I sell it? If I sell it, I bet it's going to turn around and go up. And then you get into this loop because you don't have ownership of that idea that paralyzes you from making a decision. If you understand why you bought it and you understand that's not happening, it's going down, it's time to get out. And so, you know, I think it's very dangerous for people to take stock tips. I'm obsessed with this word actionable. You know, everybody says, I want actionable ideas, I want actionable mm-hmm. advice. And as I said before, every single word of this conversation so far is actionable. Every single word of it. There just haven't been any three-letter acronyms for you to go and punch into your Bloomberg or your browser and buy. Actionable just means, can I do something with that information? And yeah, you can. Everything we've talked about, you can educate yourself. You can change the way you think about owning stock. You can maybe think twice about listening to what strangers tell you on a podcast, right? There is so much actionable information. But again, it comes down to, if you're not spoon-fed an idea, the actionable part means taking action, doing the work. And that, you know, is what I cannot counsel this new generation strongly enough mm-hmm. to do the work and to take ownership of every investment you make. Don't invest just because this guy who's got a great CV said it was a good idea.
I get inflows of Instagram DMs of people asking me, what stock should I buy? And I always go back and I tell them specifically what you just told them, because I, first of all, don't want to feel liable for your own decision. That's the first thing. The second thing is, to your point, if I give a recommendation, right, and it goes up, I look like a genius, but you have just a bigger downfall if it goes down, because then you've ruined a relationship, so to speak, right? So it's a very valid point that you're bringing up. This is very common now, like even just talking to people like in public, like at you know, networking events and stuff. They're like, what are you buying? What are you looking at? What stocks are you looking at? And I'm kind of just like, your investor philosophy and my investor philosophy are totally different. Anything I'm buying right now, you would not be able to stomach holding on to a potential position that's down 35% for 4.5 months. But if you understand the business, if you talk to the management, if you do the work, if you call the CEO, have a discussion, build that relationship with them, and then you go to these events and you just build it and you get more knowledge out of that, your level of conviction is not only based on speculation, right? There's a much bigger fundamental reinforcement behind sort of that conviction, right? So that's what I always start telling people now, because I can't be responsible for you losing money. If you want to do that, go hire an advisor and stick to diversification, right?
It's funny. People have seemed to kind of want external validation to kind of create this sense of confidence rather than utilize their skills and learn how to develop their own conviction in their investment. It's kind of like that collective framework, you know, like, ooh, everybody's buying this, therefore I need to buy this now. Rather than, if everybody's buying this, maybe I should question and go look at it. Does it make sense? Does it not make sense? And actually start dissecting. Like, everybody's jumping into Bitcoin right now when it's at 50, 60K. Guys, it went up pretty freaking fast. Like, take a step back for a second and think this through. Does it make sense to you? Can you accept the downside on this? So it's like this a hive mindset, I feel, like Wall Street Bets and all these things. People just love mania, and it really pulls them in, like this FOMO.
Well, look, the perfect poster child for that right now is happening as we speak, AMC. You know, mm-hmm. this is a company that wasn't doing very well, and it became a cause. It became, you know, this AMC 8 nonsense. And, you know, we've watched, if you look at the stock price of AMC and you pull that thing up and you look at what it's done, it's a truly extraordinary chart. You know, this was at the height of the Wall Street Bets, Reddit mania. And amazingly, the CEO, Adam Aron, has milked every single dollar out of these apes that he possibly could. And again, I've talked about this before, but is what he's done legal? Yeah. Is it ethical? Absolutely not. But he has a duty to his company and his shareholders, and a lot of these apes are shareholders. They bought the stock because they think, you know, they're blaming it on evil short selling, and they're blaming it on all this stuff, and they're talking about how the company's doing brilliantly and it's soon going to go up. And the reality is they are outmatched from a financial sophistication standpoint, and they are playing a game of which they don't understand all the rules. And to be clear, I am absolutely on their side. I think what's happened is awful, and they've lost an awful lot of money that they shouldn't have lost. But they're an angry mob, and they believe that the market is screwing them over because of, you know, what happened with GameStop. You know, I'm sure everyone remembers that and has seen the movie Dumb Money. If they haven't, it gives a pretty good outline of it. But they think the game is rigged against them, and it is. It absolutely is rigged against them, but not by the people they're blaming. It's rigged against them because the CEO of the company they're supporting is picking their pockets and has picked their pockets the whole way down. And somehow they still believe that AMC is going to the moon. It's not. You know, the debt is trading, I don't know what the yield is now on the debt, 30, 40, 50, 60% on the debt is the yield now. The shares are down at $4. They're down 7% today after the conference call last night with the results, which were pretty dreadful. And if you go through the narrative that the apes have around the stock and you pick it apart piece by piece, thread by thread, you realize that they, unfortunately, they don't have any kind of understanding about why the shares are where they are. I won't say they don't have any understanding about the business, because they're all, you know, they're all trying to support AMC. They all go to the movie theater and they think it's that simple. If I'm going to the movie theater and the CEO is telling us all these great things, why isn't the stock going up? But they're using the wrong comps. They're looking at the box office numbers, not versus like before COVID. They're not looking at the debt. They're not looking at the structure of the new stock units that the CEO sold. They just don't understand what's happening from a financial perspective, not from a price perspective. But they don't understand what is being done to them in terms of the dilution of the value of their shares by the CEO. And, you know, his obligation is obviously to keep the company alive. This idea of his duty to his fiduciary duty to shareholders is a really interesting one, because he is screwing over one set of unsophisticated shareholders to try and secure the best result for another group of shareholders who understand what's happening and will happily use every kind of pump he managed to pull out to help them unload their shares onto the unsophisticated ones. So sooner or later, that balance is going to tip and there will be more unsophisticated investors holding AMC than there are sophisticated. And so at what point, what's your fiduciary duty to your shareholders at that point? If 51% of your shareholders are unsophisticated in the ways of how credit stacks work, of how seniority works, of what happens to equity investors in the event of a bankruptcy, what's your fiduciary duty at that point? So financial markets are a very difficult, complex place in which to operate. And if you don't have an understanding of how they operate and how you need to operate within them in order to protect yourself from people who understand them better than you, they're very, very dangerous. And people, this is why we have disclaimers on every single thing that is put out in the financial world. It has a disclaimer on it these days, because this is true. You need to be warned. And sadly, people aren't.
I want to continue the conversation more. And I agree with everything you're saying. I found it also hysterical, too, when they said that they were going to acquire a gold mine to diversify into mining,
right?
Which was like the biggest red flag out there. I was laughing hysterically. I called Nick. I'm like, this is a joke, right? Are we still living in a cartoon? But I want to maybe shift the conversation more on the commodity side, because that's really your area of expertise. And that's where a lot of your research is being done right now. And I think, you know, I'm biased right now. Nick and I are pretty biased, but a lot of the charts that we're seeing, especially on a very like 30-year chart, you're really starting to see a bottoming of the cycle. And to me, that signals, okay, the contrarians who have been positioning for this, we're probably going to see some aggressive growth in the sector. So talk us through maybe what you're looking at, particularly gold, silver, copper. I'm sure there's some other commodities you might be looking at that you're positioning for the next bull run here.
Or at least the what and the, at least the how and the why.
The how and the why.
As to that feeding you into these kind of themes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about what you just said there, Dan, that probably be a strong performance from these things. So let's start with that, right? What do we mean by probably? Is it, there's a 51% chance of this happening? Is there a 99% chance of this happening, right? I mean, we don't know, obviously, but you have to kind of factor that into your conviction, and the level of that probability is something that you need to understand before you take a position on. Understand that if you look at these commodity charts, they have been cheap and getting cheaper for a long, long time. You know, we've all seen the charts showing how cheap commodities are relative to this, that, and the other over a long period of time. And they've just been getting cheaper, right? And so this comes back to everything we talked about earlier on. Why are you buying commodities? Are you buying them because you've seen that chart and you think the price is going to go up? In that case, you're owning them for one very specific reason. You think the price is going to go higher. So you should be focusing on the charts and technical factors and understanding if it breaks support, I'm out, because I'm buying them because I think probably the price is going to go up. If you think that the world is going to need commodities, a lot more of them in future, okay, that's a much longer term play. If I think the world needs a lot more commodities in the next 15 years, well, you are now thinking about, you know, at most a 15-year investment, but it's certainly going to have to allow yourself a margin of error. So you could be wrong for a couple of years and still make money over that 15-year cycle. If that's your investment case, is I think over the next 15 years, people are going to need a lot more commodities. So can you be wrong for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, right? That could happen. And then suddenly we get this lift off and the commodity space goes crazy for a decade. Seen it happen before. We've seen it happen at the turning point in every cycle. So then the next question is, okay, if I need to be able to be wrong for, let's pick 2 years. I decide that I need to give myself a 2-year window to be wrong. What's my position sizing at that point? How much of my intended investment do I put in right now, knowing if I put the whole lot in, I'm going to have to watch it go down and down and down for 2 years and then deal with the mental pressure that puts on me because I look at my daily numbers and I realize I'm losing money. Even though I went into this thinking I've got a 15-year view here, if you're down 15% to your earlier point, Dan, in the first 3 months, your mindset's going to change unless you have done the work, mm-hmm. you understand what your time horizon is, you understand what your risk tolerance is, and you're fine with being down 15-20% because you've kept some dry powder and you can average in. And then once you're in, you have to keep monitoring it. You have to keep looking at it. Are the commodities not going up like I thought they were? If not, why not? Am I wrong? Am I early? Have things changed? Every one of those is a potential yes. And if it is a yes, well, you've got decisions to make. You know, assuming that I'm going to be right and just waiting it out isn't really an option. You have to constantly check and recheck once you've got capital in play. And so, you know, it's just not that simple. Do I think commodities are unloved, to Rick Rule's point earlier on, and undervalued? Absolutely, I do. Do I believe that I've got to get in now because if I don't, I'm going to miss it? Absolutely, I don't. And so if I believe they're unloved and I believe they're undervalued, time to go to work. Time to go to work. What is undervalued? Why is it undervalued? Is it base metals? Is it precious metals? What are the catalysts for me being proven right? What is going to turn this around? Is it seeing patterns on charts about the price bottoming? Is it supply information? Is it demand information? Is it sovereign state information? Is it geopolitical information? What are the catalysts that I need to see in order for me to believe that my thesis is playing out? And all of this stuff is complicated and it takes time. And people generally don't like complications and they don't like things that are time consuming. But if you want to give yourself the best chance of success, those are the conversations you need to have. That those whys, the, you know, why am I going to be right? Why am I going to be wrong? And how am I going to position myself to give me the best chance of being this? How am I going to know if I'm right or wrong? How am I going to deal with being right? Am I going to take money off the table? How am I going to deal with being wrong? Am I going to have stops in place? There are so many hows and whys that you need to ask yourself before you get into this. If you want to give yourself the best chance, if it's purely a price deal, very different, right? Very different. You've still got hows and whys, but there's less work to do. But generally speaking, those price things, you tend to miss out on these long, multi-year long bull markets because you set yourself a price target and then you're either disciplined and you sell it too soon, which normally means you jump back in too late. Or you don't take money off the table and it goes, you know, it's risk management is an incredibly difficult piece. And that starts after you've decided that what you want to invest in. So, you know, I keep drilling this home to people. This was never an easy business to be in. These are never easy things to do. And everything that's happened over the last 20 years has been designed to project the idea that this is easy. Because the easier it is, the more money gets sucked into the Robin Hoods of the world, for example. One click and you're in and free shares for everybody and all this kind of nonsense is done purely because the easier you make it, the more money that's misguided and unsophisticated gets attracted into the space. And that's how Wall Street makes its money from the unsophisticated investors. So, you know, it's a cautionary tale, but these are important things to understand.
To finish this off, I kind of wanted to ask you one little kind of more philosophical question in the sense, you know, what do you think of this current state of affairs of the world? Does it kind of bring about any risk factors that you're thinking about, or are there any positive variables that you're kind of seeing that is leading you down a specific thesis?
Yeah, I look at it this way. I think the world is always a risky place. There is risk every day, right? As soon as you get out of bed in the morning, you're placing yourself at risk. I like to look at it and from the other way around, there are periods where the risks are less. And those are the periods where you can make investments. Like look at the early 1990s is a great example. You know, we had the Berlin Wall had come down. Communism was quote unquote defeated. Low debt, strong economy, balanced budgets in the US, there were far less risks at that point. And so it was much easier to commit capital without having to worry about all these extraneous events that could, I mean, you still had to be aware, but there were far fewer things that could turn around and surprise you. Today it's the complete opposite. You know, who ever thought we'd be talking about potential nuclear war again in Europe? Mm-hmm. But here we are. Who would have ever thought we'd be talking about the US maybe at war with China and Russia at the same time, but here we are. So the risk is always there. I think the world is an incredibly dangerous place at the moment. And I think investors have to understand that and realize that whether it is geopolitics that trips you up, or it is excessive valuations, or it is an extraordinary amount of debt that suddenly matters to people, or it is the weaponization of the US dollar, and. There are so many risks that you have to think through before you commit capital. So this is a particularly risky time in my book. As we've seen, it doesn't mean you can't make money. But if you look at US equity markets, for example, and you look at the performance of the Russell 2000 or the S&P without the Mag 6, I'm not including Tesla anymore, you will see that you haven't really made much money. You just haven't. And so understand that there's a very narrow group of stocks leading these all-time highs, and the headlines are great, but you really understand what's happening here. And those are particularly precarious. When the breadth diminishes like that, it's a particularly precarious time to have money committed to stocks you don't know potentially or don't understand. You're just buying because everybody else is going up. So I would always urge caution, because this isn't something you can often do with abandon. March 2009 was probably the last time we had, with the exception of the COVID bottom in March 2020, but that was so short-lived. But March 2009 was probably the last time we had, and that's what, 15 years ago now, that you could just buy with both hands and turn the screens off, knowing that the entry prices you got in a lot of those things were going to give you a stupendously good chance of making good returns. We haven't had that, say, apart from the COVID bottom, really, since then. Maybe periods during the European debt crisis, if you knew what you were doing, you knew the right assets, not asset classes, to buy. But it's not often the markets give you easy entry points.
Grant, this has been a very insightful conversation. I think the main takeaway from our side, I mean, we've been applying this, but I think for the audience, is it's not the what, it's the how and the why for the investment ideas. So that's, again, very simple advice for everyone listening. You got to do the work. That's just, you it's do. Just really,
there's no,
that
there's no substitute. I'm afraid.
There's no substitute for it. So Grant, where can the listeners find you?
Very easy. Just my website is grant-williams.com. And on Twitter, you'll find me at TTMYGH, which is the acronym for things that make you go,
Great piece of content, guys. Really highly recommend you guys check it out. And Grant, again, thank you so much for coming on here. It's been a very interesting discussion. And look, I guess we'll see you next time when things are looking a little bit brighter, especially on the on the metal side too, right?
There you go.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on the New Gen Mindset Podcast.
Thanks, guys. Take care.